talk smack, and drink bourbon.
Currently, the Senate budget, I don't know that it's set up for conference. It's set up more for a standoff.
All right, listeners, it's great to have you back at Bourbon in the Back Room for the 15th episode of our second season. We're here in the capital city talking about things that matter in South Carolina government and politics. You'll hear news and information you won't hear anywhere else right here on Bourbon in the Back Room. Remind your friends and family that they can tune in as well. Or check us out at BITBR Podcast, Facebook, or Twitter. And send us your thoughts and information on our email account. That's bourboninthebackroom@gmail.com. We love to hear your comments, suggested guests, or anything else you just want us to say on the air. All right, Joel, we are going to have a great show today. We've got a guest, a repeat guest, who was here in our inaugural season, but is going to be saying goodbye to the South Carolina General Assembly after more than, I believe, 30 years, but we'll hold that.
Vincent, good to be back with you, buddy. And by the way, the episode we did last week at the Rotary Club is like jumping off the charts. We really dug deep on some important issues, this death penalty case, the USC board, the splitting of DHEC, and got a lot of people involved, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, thank you again, Capital Rotary Club, for having us. Joel, I think we're going to go more on the road this summer, right, and go out and visit some of our listeners and friends out there across the state.
Yep, I've heard from the Schwartz family, and we're doing their bar mitzvah.
I can't wait.
All right.
So, I've been to a bar mitzvah, a lot of liquor there.
You have been. You had your share at ours. So anyway, back to Bourbon Briefs. So we're going to ask our special guest about this one today, Vincent, but I want to talk a little bit about firsthand this big tax break that the legislature spent all year debating last year with Panthers and their owner and Rock Hill and the state of South Carolina. Ask me where that is today.
Yeah, in the toilet.
It is going nowhere. And apparently the Panthers are now pulling away. They allege that the city of Rock Hill didn't fulfill their financial obligation. Meanwhile, the state has their deal that they were part of, and I guess that's no longer to be the case. What does it mean, and is there something that we could have done differently?
Well, Joel, actually, you'll recall this was 2 years ago that this fight occurred, and I remember that because I was still in the Senate. I voted against this package. I was one of only a handful to vote against.
Oh, so you were there when this happened?
I was.
This
2020.
Okay.
Harpootlian led the fight against it.
We're not going to say Dick Harpootlian was right on this podcast.
He was right. He was right. And I say good riddance to this deal. It was a bad deal, Joel. We don't need the state taxpayers, need to be plowing money in a billionaire's, the guy that owns this thing is a multi-billionaire, into a billionaire's sports complex. It doesn't even house the stadium. You know, this was a practice center. So where does it leave us? Well, you know, the tax breaks, they don't really matter because they go away when the project's not done. I would be very curious, and I hope to find out what actual money was spent by the state and local governments in furtherance of this project. You know, was there any engineering done, architecture done, ground turned? And did the state and the county or the city have to pay for any of that?
I'm sure some consultants got paid along the way.
I'm sure they got paid a lot of money.
Yeah, that's where the money's always spent, right?
But I'd love to see that, and I hope somebody will dig and find out. And listeners, if you want to dig and find out and let us know here at Bourbon in the Back Room, we'd love to share it with our audience.
Absolutely. Vincent, I want to move on to an issue that has really percolated a lot over the last few weeks, the University of South Carolina Board of Trustees. And I want to say something real quick before we dig too deep. I think it's pretty remarkable that our university does as well as it does, achieves the rankings that it does.
This is a good setup.
Despite the chaos of the board. Would you agree with that,
Amen.
Though?
I mean you know,
the law school, the international business school, the honors program, these are great worldwide programs.
Let me just take this moment in this intro to remind our listeners that we do have the number one public honors program in America at the University of South Carolina.
Absolutely, yeah.
You put on a podcast there.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because you teach there. Okay.
So, yes, it is pretty amazing. I think it says something about the faculty, the staff, and the students that in the midst of this chaos and dysfunction, they're still able to make it happen.
And I'm going to give also credit to our good friend, Dr. Harris Pastides, who had a great tenure there, wrapping up his second time there.
Laughing on his way out the door.
Yeah, but what a great guy, a good friend of both of ours, and just, you know,
we need to get him on the show, Joel.
Yeah, he wants to come on the show. I talked to him this week. Good. He'll be retiring, I think, at the end of June. He's got, I think, 13 or 15 graduations to go to. Hell, I can't stay awake at one. Can you imagine going to 15? All right, Vincent, let me take you now to the Senate Education Subcommittee yesterday, an exchange between our good friends and both former guests on the political podcast that everyone loves, Bourbon in the Back Room, Senator Darrell Jackson and Dick Harpootlian, and then I'm going to have you break this down for us.
Whatever we do, it is very important and urgent that we don't put the same contaminated leadership back in a position to make that situation even worse, and perhaps knowing that they may be lame ducked may become even more dangerous, right?
Well, and we have a new president coming in July 1. It's important that new president not have to deal with these folks, in my opinion, because they're not going to break their habits. They're not going to stop doing what they're doing. So I would beg, whatever, that y'all do something to get them out while the new trustees are being elected from whatever configuration. I also ask you not to just rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic.
And then finally, Senator, when you say do something, you mean perhaps use this as a vehicle, this legislation as a vehicle to pass something that would address the possibility of them continuing to serve until
I think it's absolutely imperative that you remove them from the board immediately.
So, Vincent, let me bring you and our listeners up to date. Okay, so you may recall last week we heard what the House did, and they, as you know, shrunk the board to 13 members.
It still seems like a lot. Yeah,
yeah, well, the Senate raised the limit today. They went back to 15 members, so they added two members. And the Senate today, in the full committee today, we're taping this show on a Thursday, has now passed a bill. Where I think the mainstream media, here I'm talking about mainstream media, they're putting out these headlines that have confused everybody.
The damn mainstream media.
I'm telling you. I swear. If you want to get news, come to Bourbon in the Back Room, right? That and Fitz News will tell you everything you need to know. But they keep saying legislature votes to oust incumbents. Okay, here's the way this breaks down for you and all of our listeners, all right? What they're basically going to do is their elections next May, and as you've described before on this podcast, the General Assembly will have a joint assembly. The Senate marches over to the House. We have, you know, in the bigger chamber, and we elect board members to universities. We elect judges that way. The only name they've reported favorable is that of Alex English. The other five incumbents will not get reported out favorably. But it really, for practical purposes, doesn't matter, because what the bill does, it says it reconstitutes the board. Whether you're 13 or 15 seats will be open next year. Several are, you know, a couple are appointed by the governor. I think the superintendent of education comes off. But the seven congressional districts will be elected by the General Assembly. So obviously this—
How do the other ones get selected?
Some get selected by the—
Alumni board and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. We'll go through all the details on it.
All right, but so basically what you're telling our listeners is, regardless of whether these guys get reelected this year, next year it's vacant and it starts over.
And it could easily pit two incumbents against each other. So if somebody wants to run again and they currently serve today, there's nothing that says they can't run next year. Well, some of them are at large, too, by the way. You got like seven districts and several at large.
Makes sense.
So people can run again, so they're not being ousted, okay? Anyone is free to run. I could name for you, I know several members that I think would be crazy to run, two in particular, okay?
Absolutely.
Interesting, along with that, our friend Charles Williams wrote an interesting editorial.
Charles Williams from Orangeburg has been a board member of USC for a while, was against Kaslin coming, if I recall correctly.
And Charles wrote a great, did a great interview in the Orangeburg Times and Democrat just this week. Where he says, look, he says, I get it. People are pissed off about Kaslin. I was against that. I get it. People are pissed off about the buyout of Will Muschamp's. I was against that. Charles Williams will also tell you he was very much involved in and preventing them from firing Frank Martin last year. So he feels like he's kind of getting thrown under the bus with everybody
else. That's the way the world works, though, Joel Lurie.
And to that point, I know that Senator Jackson in that hearing yesterday made a very interesting comparison. He talked about the South Carolina State and how that board was reconstituted.
True.
And he basically said, look, remember, there were some pretty good board members, but at the end of the day, if you're going to start with a clean slate, yeah. you're going to say, I don't think we will start with a complete clean slate.
And of course, Charles could run for the new board and see what happens.
To be honest with you, if I was in the legislature, I would encourage him to run, okay? Yeah. Because I think he was on the right side of this important issue. So, again, breaking this down for you like you can only get on Bourbon in the Back Room. Vincent, we get so many comments about how much people appreciate the time we take to dig deep into these issues. All right, Vincent, back to an issue that we talked in great detail about, this scheduled execution of death row inmate Richard Moore. You remember we talked about this last week.
Right, how that works with the firing squad or the chair and the choices that have to be made and the results.
Yep, and you may recall that this case is of particular interest for two reasons. One, he would be the first to have the opportunity to choose a firing squad, which, by the way, he has done now.
Yes, yes.
And secondly, Justice Kay Hearn wrote the dissenting opinion saying, I've upheld plenty of death row cases. I don't think this meets that standard. Right. So the Supreme Court has just hit a pause. The execution was scheduled for April 29th. I think they're going to release more information in the days and weeks ahead. And I think one of the things that Richard Moore's attorneys are arguing is that, number one, did the state really attempt to secure the chemicals necessary to do a lethal injection?
Right.
And number two, is this firing squad execution method really constitutional? Where do you see this going in the next weeks?
Well, I think ultimately it's probably going to go forward. I'm glad that the court paused to actually consider these issues because this is uncharted territory for South Carolina. It is a terrible reflection of our state in the country when you have a firing squad brought back. But I think ultimately it'll probably move forward. And, you know, we'll just have to see where it goes. And this is an important issue that people really need to look in their hearts and think hard about how we want the death penalty to be carried out in South Carolina and what do we want it to say about our society.
No question about it. I mean, we are making national news for all the wrong reasons. All right, Vincent, it's time to do our weekly update on your favorite race. What's that one called?
The race to replace Nancy Mace.
All right, so we got two big updates for you. Just today, breaking news. Congressman Joe Wilson, this is very rare. I don't know that I've seen this happen in a long time, has endorsed the opponent of one of his delegation members. So Joe Wilson has endorsed Katie Arrington. Okay. And that's very unusual that one Republican would endorse the opponent of another delegation member.
It's kind of like the unwritten rule, Joel, that's just something you don't do. I mean, even if you don't like the person, you just don't do it.
I'm going to take a quote from Congressman Wilson's press release today, and I quote Congressman Wilson. These are his words, not mine. Quote, as murderers and enemies of freedom grow emboldened by the feeble leadership of the Biden administration, Washington needs more people who understand the significant implications of a weak America on the world stage. That's why I'm endorsing Katie Arrington for Congress. Remind me again, Vincent, was it Biden that was so close to Putin?
Yep, right. I'll just say that quote you read, if people wonder what is wrong with America, just read that quote.
Well, the question
that's what's wrong with America.
Do you think people in that district really give a shit about what Joe Wilson thinks?
All I'm going to say is,
Okay, well, in other news in that race, I'm going to thank my friends at Fitz News real quick because they posted a video.
Our friend Will Folks over at Fitz News.
Former guest, great guy. We need to get him back on.
Yeah.
But they posted an interesting clip of a recent low country woman, GOP woman meeting in Beaufort. And there seemed to be some people.
Okay, I'm going to go to, if you want to hear what's wrong with America, listen to this clip.
Okay, if you want to. This Nancy Mace got a little more than she bargained for. So here we go here.
Okay, I just want to ask you something very quickly. Do you feel that Donald Trump was responsible for January 6th? Do you see him as an insurrectionist? And should all these people that are still in jail be?
Okay, so, as a Republican on the civil rights committee, I told everybody, I don't care what you've been arrested for, if you have lacked due process, whether it's January 6th or another, call our office and we will assist you. There are members of Congress who are Democrats. If you are arrested for January 6th, they will turn you away and they will not help you. Okay, and so it's really important that we understand that that part of it, number one. Number two, I've been working on civil rights issues for a long, long time, both as a state lawmaker and as a member of Congress. So I don't care who you are or what's happened, call our office and we'll help you. To date, we've not had anybody in the district have their due process rights for the January 6th.
I have a great guest. She has 30 minutes. It's her time to use it any way she wants to.
Thank you. Go ahead. Next question.
Oh, she can't answer it.
Okay, so Vincent, I don't know how I missed that gathering.
Okay. I
think I was like, I don't know what I was doing that day, but it was something better than going to this event. Okay.
Yeah, people, yeah, exactly. I mean, focus on what matters. It does take me back to our interview with Congressman Clyburn. We asked him what was the greatest change he had seen, and I thought he would say, you know, politics or the ideology or the right wing or the left wing or something like that. And instead, he said something I thought was very profound. He said that it was civility. And Joel, if you think about it, all these problems that we have right now, if people were just civil with each other instead of what you saw or and heard in that video clip, it would solve almost all these problems.
Well, I mean, somebody asked her a simple question.
Right.
You know, do you think Trump was responsible for January 6th? And she could have said, look, I think he helped create the atmosphere. But she didn't answer the question, okay, which really pissed
because
a lot of people
off.
Because
she was afraid to answer it in that
way. You know,
movie,
she
right?
didn't answer it. Remember, she came out with a statement right. a day or two later. And then she went into this diatribe about, if your rights have been trampled on and you need due process, call my office. Let me tell you something. Call our office. We've actually called our office to try to get her on the show, and we haven't had much success there. But Vincent, truthfully, it shows you something that you and I have talked about for over a year now. People are scared to death to even say Donald Trump burped in this room.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know,
a podcast scorned. Be careful.
Vincent, I want to close with a story, actually, a very distressing news item. And Greg Gregory touched on this more than any of our previous guests, and that's the issue of guns.
Right.
Okay. And over the weekend, there were three shootings in the country that grabbed everyone's attention. I don't know what the definition of a mass shooting is, but a shooting in public. Two of them were in the great state of South Carolina.
I remember
one
sad.
At a nightclub in Hampton County, one at Columbiana Center, a beautiful mall out off of Harbison Boulevard. I think the other one was at a party in Pittsburgh. But our friend, someone that we tend to quote a lot on this show, Dick Harpootlian, is talking about new legislation, because if you talk to people in law enforcement, they'll tell you most of these crimes are committed with guns that have been obtained illegally.
Right.
So
sure,
let me play a quick clip Mary Green did for WCSC Channel 5 that discusses Harpootlian's proposal.
I was a deputy solicitor and solicitor for 12 years. I've prosecuted my share of cases, and I've defended my share of cases. This course of conduct is so epidemic that it is challenging and destroying the fabric of our society. If you have a pistol permit, that's fine, although you can't carry a pistol into the mall, it's posted. You can carry it hunting or fishing. You can carry it to and from your home. You can carry it in your car if it's in the glove box.
Now there are. What do you think, Vincent? Will any legislation dealing with guns ever pass in South Carolina?
I do. I think Dick's proposal here is smart, because what he is doing is focusing on illegal conduct. In other words, he's not trying to change the laws around guns in South Carolina. He's trying to say, okay, if someone's breaking the law, we should make the punishment greater. And I think that's a smart route to go. You know, I'm not usually a big supporter of mandatory minimums, but I certainly think there's a way to enhance the penalty so that we can really crack down on this and scare people into people who are going to break the law and let them know that if they do it, they're going to be going away for a long time.
Yeah, and I'm also interested, and I'm not a lawyer, but I'm interested in some of the bond provisions of this. Vincent, one of the criticisms was that the first person arrested was set free on a bond this weekend. So I think there are a lot of ways to improve the system. and going after these illegal gun purchases is a start, but a very important start. All right, we're now going to take a break, hear from some of our sponsors, and can't wait to introduce a special guest who's got some exciting news today. All right, we're back. During this break, I've got the pleasure of talking to my good friend, Todd Augsburger. Todd is the president and CEO of Lexington Medical Center, who is a proud sponsor of Bourbon in the Backroom. Todd, welcome back.
Thank you both for having me.
So I got to tell you, just talking to a friend of mine recently, and she and her husband just delivered their first child at Lexington Medical Center. And Todd, they couldn't stop talking about what a great experience it was. This is a real specialty for y'all.
Well, I'm glad they had a great experience, Joel. Our nurses and staff go out of their way to make this as a positive experience as possible. Most folks may not know that Lexington Medical Center delivers more babies than any other hospital in the state of South Carolina.
You know, in addition to that, specializing in heart, neurosurgery, cancer, you guys have really become one of the premier hospitals in the Southeast, and that's why we're so proud to have you as our sponsor, and we thank you for what you do for our community. We'll be right back.
Joel, do you remember when I was the chair of the Senate Arts Caucus?
I certainly remember that. Why do you ask, Vincent?
Well, one of our sponsors today is the South Carolina Arts Alliance. They were one of our biggest supporters to promote the arts in South Carolina. Joel, they're a 40-year-old nonprofit organization, the only statewide art service organization in South Carolina that focuses on advocacy, leadership, and development. They help small arts organizations around South Carolina with funding, with advocacy, and with putting on the arts. And Joel, you know what?
They are now a proud sponsor of Bourbon in the Back Room. We'll be right back.
Art matters.
Okay, we are back, and thanks again for our great sponsors. But Vincent, we have got a special guest, a repeat guest, but he's got a lot to talk about, a lot going on in his chamber and a lot going on in his part of the state. Introduce our guests.
That's right, Joel. And remember, there have been very few repeat guests. I mean, this might be one of only three that's been invited back on the show thus far, but we have our good friend Gary Simrell. Listeners, you'll remember Gary was elected to the House of Representatives in the early 1990s as one of those few members who actually served when Democrats were in control. Gary was one of the early Republicans elected as a young guy, is the senior Republican in the House of Representatives, one of the longest serving legislators in the General Assembly, is currently the leader of the Republicans in the South Carolina House of Representatives, hails from York County.
All right, it's enough already. Let him talk.
Was a member of the Eating Caucus back in the day with me and
got great others. Hair. Got great
got
hair.
Got good hair. Yeah. Sells great cars. Gary, welcome back to the show, man.
Glad to be here.
And Gary, let's just go right to it. A lot is happening in the South Carolina House of Representatives right now. You're only going to serve for another few months, but today I believe the Speaker of the House, our friend Jay Lucas, resigned as Speaker.
He announced his resignation.
Okay, tell us what's going on.
So he announced his resignation effective the end of sine die, which for us is May 12th at 5 p.m. We will have an election for his successor, which will be Merle Smith, who's current chairman of Ways and Means.
By the way, does Merle have any opposition, or is he running unopposed, as far as you know?
No opposition. It should be by acclamation.
And I'll just stop there and say Merle Smith was part of what we'll call the triumvirate, which was Gary Simrell, Jay Lucas, and Merle Smith. Two of you are leaving, and it sounds like Merle, who's chairman of Ways and Means, has been working hard to line up the votes to become the Speaker.
So go from a three-legged stool to a pogo stick.
That's a good description of Merle.
Two of you are moving out, and one of you is moving up. How about that?
So that's why the Speaker decided to announce his resignation, so there could be an orderly transfer of power.
Orderly transfer, and the election would actually happen on April 28th, sometime that morning. That's a Thursday, usually a light day for us.
So that's next week.
Session. Yeah. That's next Thursday, but he would not assume the role until 5:01 p.m., basically on May the 12th. This allows the time for H2, when the budget comes back from right. The Senate, to have that. And interestingly enough, when I was elected in 1992, your uncle Bob Shaheen was the Speaker.
Yeah.
And in 1994, when Governor David Beasley was elected, there was a shift in power in the House. When I was elected, there were 43 Republicans out of 124 body. So obviously, there are 44 Democrats today, just to give you.
Yeah,
so it's almost,
almost the exact
reverse of that of the opposite. But then 1994 comes around with the election. There's a shift in power. Speaker Shaheen loses his election to David Wilkins. David Wilkins served until 2005, and George Bush appointed him to be ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Canada. So that was a little different. Bobby Harrell came in after him, and of course, Bobby left in a not-so-orderly fashion.
Right.
He was removed, and Jay Lucas, who was the speaker pro tem, became acting speaker during that time and then was elected speaker. So in reality, what we talk about today, I haven't seen in 30 years. So when somebody says, what is the normal, what is protocol? Well, this is the protocol because we haven't seen anything. The precedent is not there. But in this case, we've got that orderly transition, a meshing of power. You have two strong leaders, and I think this is the best way to go. So Merle will be speaker as we go through the fall, as we get the budget completed in June, go through the fall. And as you know, we work beyond the sine die on other issues. Elections of 2022, Mr. Smith, Merle Smith, would have to be reelected as speaker.
All right, so let's pause for a second because you've gone over a lot. And one of the things people like about our show is we try to explain a lot about the process, okay? So you mentioned the term sine die, and that's in May now. It used to be first Thursday in June. It's now what day?
The second Thursday in May.
All right, so second Thursday in May. And explain what can and cannot happen after that day, because I think that's real important, Gary, for people to understand, well, why don't y'all take up this bill when you come back? Explain that a little bit more.
So we have a set term for these sessions. Each session is a two-year session. So for each year of the session, there is a beginning and there's an end. The end, the sine die end that we have. You can go beyond sine die. You must have a sine die resolution because what happens, especially us moving these dates forward, as you mentioned, Joel, from the first Thursday in June to the second Thursday in May, cutting that time frame off, the budget technically doesn't go into effect until 7/1, that fiscal year that happens. And so within the sine die resolution, and the sine die resolution basically tells what we can come back for.
It says you can come back for these limited few things.
Limited things. One is the budget. If we have some unfinished business, we can always put that in the sine die.
You know, one of the remarkable things in thinking about that back in 2015, and we've talked about this a few times with the horrific tragedy that happened in Charleston, but to even be able to talk about passing a bill to get the flag down, we had to do what first, Vincent?
We had to first force it into the sine die resolution, which was not in the least bit easy, but was certainly worthwhile. Gary, let me take you back to the leadership changes that are occurring, because listeners, if you think about it, we have Gary Simrell leaving after a long tenure. He's the head of the Republican caucus. We now have Jay Lucas leaving. He is the Speaker of the House, basically the figurehead and the leader of the House. And that means that, and now we have Merle Smith leaving to become Speaker.
It's like musical chairs.
Who was the head of the Ways and Means Committee. So we're going to see complete and total change in the leadership in the House, Gary. Tell us about the other seats coming open, your majority leader positions coming open. Who's likely to get that? Who's running for that? Who will be running for the Ways and Means chairman that's going to be opening up? Give us the lay of the land.
So let's take it from the top. Of course, Jay Lucas stepping down as Speaker. Merle Smith becomes Speaker, which creates a vacancy because Mr. Smith will no longer be on Ways and Means. There are actually five vacancies that we know of from retirees. And of course, four retirees, Mr. Smith ascending.
There's a lot of turnover in the House, and that's not unusual, really.
It is not, and it's interesting. Yeah. People talk about term limits a lot, and I know we're off subject a hair, but it's important because the attrition rate within the House of Representatives, I've been there 30 years. I'm number three in seniority. Right. I'm the senior Republican. So if you'll look at the attrition rate, it actually is high.
Lots of turnover.
People do not serve for long periods of time. So Merle Smith becomes the Speaker, creates the vacancy on Ways and Means. There would be an election for a Ways and Means chair at that point, elected by the members, the 24 members at that point, unless Mr. Smith decides to place a member. There's a vacancy now. He can always place.
He can put a new member on Ways and Means.
A member.
Who are we hearing wants to be Ways and Means chair?
There are four people that are wishing to be Ways and Means chair. I don't really want to name their name because they don't want them out there.
We'll do that when you get off the air.
There are four people who are interested in that, and we'll see what happens there.
How about majority leader, Republican leader?
Well, and as majority leader, you know, my term ends after the elections in November. At this juncture, I'm not planning to step down as majority leader unless I would be needed in another facet. And so we'll play that as it comes. But at this point, obviously, steadiness in leadership to make sure there's that smooth transition that we talked about, but just running the day-to-day operations, whether it's of the caucus or whether it's of the House, those things are important. We've always talked about this, and I know we agree on this issue, that the institution itself is far more important than any one individual.
Yes.
So I always want to make sure in everything that we're doing, the institution is paramount to anything we do individually.
Or the issues that come before you from day to day, those issues will come back and they tend to recycle. But if the institution's not working, you can't deal with the issues.
That's I have some I've got some pretty strong speculation about members that will potentially ascend to those positions. Don't have to ask, you don't have to comment, but I'm hearing the names for Ways and Means. It would not surprise me to see something with Bruce Bannister and Bill Herb Kirschman, or two names, both two House veterans, steady guys, level-headed in what they do. Maybe there are more. I'm sure there are more. I'm hearing from Majority Leader maybe Jay Jordan and Davey Hyatt, and I'm sure there are more there. So won't ask you to comment on that because it puts you in an awkward position, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. Gary, before we get too far into your interview, we want to talk about your retirement. And Vincent, I want you to join me in a quick bourbon shot, a bourbon toast for House Majority Leader Gary Semrel, who will be retiring after almost three decades of service. Cheers.
There's to you, Gary Semrel. We're going to take a short break and hear a word from one of our incredible sponsors, and then we'll be right back, listeners, with Gary Semrel.
All right, during the break, we're going to talk to a good friend of mine, Patrick Cobb, the Associate Director for South Carolina AARP. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
You know, AARP does such great work both around the state and at the State House. In many of the battles you and I fought together, what are the top two legislative accomplishments that come to your mind that you're most proud of?
Well, I think one that I'm very proud of was the regulation of the predatory lending industry in South Carolina, because payday loans affect so many people in this state, and you were right there with us fighting along in the trenches. And then the other one would be the overhaul of some of the utility legislation that happened a couple years ago that helped consumers and save some money in their pockets.
Well, you guys do such great work. So proud to work with you in those efforts and many, many more, and so proud to have you as a sponsor of Bourbon in the Back Room. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. Gary.
We're getting paid now, Gary. We got sponsors,
right. That's
man.
That's right. I mean, I'm telling you.
Gary, you were on the show about a year ago, and I kind of sensed that maybe you were approaching the end of your career, and you had some great things to say in your interview. I read a long article. I think it was in the state newspaper. Great quotes from people like Vincent and Gilda Cobb Hunter, both sides of the aisle, you know, just saying great things about you. You even, I think, quoted John F. Kennedy in that article. But how did you break this down? How did you come to the decision? You're still a young guy in your mid-50s. Now was the time to go home.
Greg Delaney, former chair of Judiciary, told me when he was getting ready to retire, I said, Greg, don't leave. We need you, man. And he says, let me tell you something. When you know, you'll know. And I know.
Yep.
So somebody said, you know, are you gonna reconsider this? And I said, I'm going to Dr. Seuss it. I said what I meant, and I meant what I said. and it was just a marker for me.
Yeah.
And it's almost Seinfeldian in nature.
Is that a new word? Seinfeldian.
That you leave them wanting a little more. You still have a little bit of toothpaste still in the tube.
Yeah.
So and that to me was important in the accomplishments in the building of relationships. You know, when I was elected, I was elected in a partisan race. I was a Republican running in Rock Hill where the Democrats ruled. And so there was this opposition feeling that you know, we were the good guys, they were the bad guys, they thought they were the good guys, and we were the bad guys. At the end of the day, I get elected, and I come to Columbia as a partisan. And I quickly realized.
Used to drive Uncle Bob crazy, man.
Used to drive Uncle Bob.
Gary Roll Call Simrel.
And Uncle Bob used to stomp his foot at me, call me an infidel.
And Uncle Bob was correct.
And the interesting part of behind that, though, is that it, in my heart of hearts, I was a South Carolinian.
Yeah.
I joke now I'm a big R Rock Hilly and a little R Republican. The facts are that relationships matter, people matter more than party, and to accomplish something, someone will say, what did you accomplish in the General Assembly? Nothing. You can't accomplish anything. It takes we. We have to do stuff. And so that building of consensus versus compromise started taking shape in me, and whether it's seasoning or maturing, whatever happened along that way, I grew into that role of recognizing the importance of people above party. Then I become majority leader where we are partisan in nature,
right?
You know, and I refuse to go down that road.
Yeah, you've managed to be a bipartisan partisan leader. It is a pretty amazing trick.
I'm going to quote somebody from that article.
Quote, my first impression of him was here's this slick guy, total politico, no substance, just a slick Republican hack. This is before I know him, said former state senator Vincent Chaines.
Really, you pulled off a crazy role. You were the leader of a partisan group, and you did it in the only thing I can say is kind of a bipartisan manner. How does that work?
It was threading a needle, but it does work if, again— What is the motive and what is the end result you seek? And I seek consensus.
Yeah.
I'm a consensus builder, and that's the way we make that happen.
Yeah, you know, Gary, also, a lot of people wouldn't know this because you're obviously coming across as the serious professional that you are, but he's got a great sense of humor.
He's done some
great imitations.
Right.
You want to do any of those on air?
Oh, of course not. Well, you can break out the bourbon.
Especially the David Wilkins.
Give us one, buddy. Just give us a Wilkins imitation.
I have to think about Wilkins a little while. You put me on the spot. Come back, and I'll think of some people.
Okay, but Gary— you may have lost your first race. You did lose your first race.
Yeah, I didn't. I lost it.
Yeah. You lost by a couple hundred votes.
169, actually.
But you really won the grand prize in that race, didn't you?
I got a wife out of the
day. There you go. Yeah. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, so campaigning back in the day, right. I mean, obviously there's no laptop, there's no cell phone, and you have to write things on a 3x5 card because that's what fits in your pocket. And so I'm campaigning one day, and I knock on this door. Nice lady comes to the door. We're talking about that time. Her daughter pulls up in the driveway and gets out of the car, and I was like, whoa, she was like 100% attractive. And whew, I was taken aback, you know, and I said, I'm trying to scribble notes, and I'm like, what, you know, where am I? I'm confused and dazed at this point. And so I put a star and an asterisk by this.
About that one. That's how he coded
I'm
not going.
I'm going
right.
to go back. I'm going to follow up over there. Well, ironically, I was in a cafeteria in Rock Hill, and this cafeteria was great for politicking because you walked in, it was open. So you could see everybody seated
and they saw
as you were in the line. And so you knew kind of which tables to go to. So it was just a perfect setup. Lo and behold, I see my future wife, Mary Ruth, and her mother dining. So naturally, I went to that table. Her mother opened the door. Red carpet rolls out. And she says, what does your girlfriend think of you running for office? I said, interesting that
what
you should ask. Because there's not one. And I ended up getting my future wife's phone number written on the back of the receipt.
I love it.
From Jackson's cafeteria.
Well, I have met Mayor Ruth, and she is beautiful today, as I'm sure she was 30
She's
years ago.
She's more beautiful today than she was.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What a great
story. Let me tell you something. If you'd have never won an election, you still won the grand prize. But the funny thing is, Vincent, I've since found out neither his mother-in-law or his wife voted for him in that election.
That's even freaking better. That's so good. You know, Gary, I'm sitting here thinking about your comments of how you grew into office, and before that, your comments about term limits. And I serve in some national elected leadership organizations, and the folks that live in those term-limited states, sometimes a maximum of 6 years, they always talk about how just when they figure out what's going on, then they can't serve anymore. But thinking about what you just said, there's this maturing process that takes, if you're a decent human being, kind of the partisan hate out of you, and you mature into building these relationships. And I would suppose if the term limits had been there for you, you might never involved into the leader. And that doesn't mean that you don't need people who cycle in and out quickly. You're always going to have them. But having this growth, I think, is important. What are your thoughts?
I do think it is. And I think your term limits are at the ballot box, not in some written document. And in the other part of that, and I've said this before, and somebody said, God, that may be seen as offensive to, you know, 80% of the audience you just said this to. I said, no, because they think they're in the 20%. That I've talked about, and that is how government actually operates.
Right.
So you take 170 members of the General Assembly at any one time, I think there are 20% or fewer of those in the mid-30s somewhere that actually know fundamentally and pragmatically how government functions and operates.
Right.
And you only know that by learning that process. This isn't a course you take in school. It is a learned effect. And so for that reason, if you put term limits in, you would limit the ability for those folks that want to learn how government operates. And staff, the bureaucracy, that would be who was running the government. And who are they answerable to? So you've cut out the citizenry of having accountability through the term limit. So while it sounds good over here, the unintended consequence that you face is a government that's actually less accountable to you, not more accountable to you. And that is just a fact. It's a reality.
Yeah, that's a great point. I kind of fall somewhere in the middle. I mean, I think 6 years, Vincent, is not nearly enough time. Hell, it took me 6 years just to know how to get from my car to my Senate office, right? But I do think people don't need to serve 40 and 50 years either, okay? Because you need first. I want to ask you a quick question because we want to dig into some of the current issues. What's next for Gary Semrel?
That's a good question. I was already in my car business. I was abbreviating it and going really just kind of a wholesale only. I got in the car business because I loved cars.
Sure. And you decided, if I remember correctly, after 9/11, you wanted to do something you really love doing. Am I right?
The fragility of life hit me when I saw, you know, what was happening around the world in that fleet moment.
Yep.
Listeners, for a more detailed discussion of that, you need to tune into our first interview with Gary Semrel in season one of the podcast.
Absolutely. But anyway, what's next for you?
I'll answer that question for you. Life is next.
Yeah. Okay, so my good friend Vincent Shaheen actually tweeted to me for others to read as well about there's life after politics.
It's wonderful. Here's
the interesting dynamic for me, though. Elected at 25, I'm 55 now. That's 30 years. So of my life, more than half has been spent in elected office. So
I wouldn't say that too loudly.
Well, but it's a dynamic that then you, when you pivot from that, what does that look like?
Sure.
Exactly. So when the story broke on the Twitter feed from the state newspaper, Mayon Schechter, who did the article.
Great. We've had Mayon as a guest.
Mayon does a great job. But she texted me at like 6:55 a.m. and says, this article is going to hit at 7 o'clock. I said, thank you. So I pulled it up. It was long, very long.
Yeah.
I'm ADD. I couldn't get through it. But I started reading it, and I became emotional.
Yeah.
And so my wife started reading it, and she became emotional. And so I was like, oh, this is now reality. You're seeing it in print. By the time I got to Columbia and saw all the machinations and people dividing up your clothes, fighting for your office, I thought, I'm over it.
Yeah.
It's time to move on.
So, you know when you know.
So my morning period lasted about an hour and 45 minutes.
Well, I'll say for our listeners, maybe some young listeners who want to be in office, the best advice I ever got, and Gary, my observation of you as you lived it this way too is, and that's why you'll be fine not in office, never let the role define who you are.
Sure.
And Gary Semrel was always more than Representative Gary Semrel, and that's why you'll go off and have a wonderful endeavor outside of elected office.
And you'll continue to find ways to give back to your community, and you'll also have fun. Let's dig deep on some issues now. Gary, it's got to be disappointing to you to see what the breakdown is happening with the Panthers deal. Can you we talked about this a little bit earlier in the podcast, but can you kind of give us an update of how we got to where we are after all the hard work that you and so many others put into this project 2 years ago?
Well, and let's break it down a little bit because there are components to it that I think are important because we get and I understand this because it's the issue of the day,
right,
of the termination of the contract with the Panthers headquarters. But in reality, what happened with the legislation that we passed and how we were able to pass that, and that was using the ability of seasoned politics.
Gary, don't look at me. I voted against it.
To make it happen, though. But I held up the sign eat eye resolution.
Yeah, I remember that.
Let me just stop because it was masterful. He stood there in the Senate chamber where you don't belong. But we were happy to have you. But, you know, you can tell when somebody's there, Joel, who's not a senator. And
they kind of stand out, particularly when they're a House member.
But he did it in a way that was not hostile like certain House members of Cumber did it, but it was just very carefully crafted that he was there. Everybody knew he was holding up the signing die resolution and he was talking to allies in the Senate. It was masterful work.
You're saying it wasn't like when Katie Arrington came over and stared down Thomas McElby that time? All right, Gary, anyway, go back.
It was not like that.
Yes, it was not.
But that legislation is important because what it did for South Carolina is introduced the ability to accommodate a pro sports team. And that can happen in any of the 46 counties. So for us, legislatively, I thought that was an important benchmark for us because it set South Carolina up for more successes down the road, regardless of the Carolina Panthers. So I think the legislation was warranted, and that was good. So in the paper where I said disappointed in the Panthers' outcome, no regrets on our end. And I stand by that.
Now, sure, that makes sense.
The local side of that, really, at the end of the day, what I think this has to do with more than contracts is expectations in delivery and what one side thought and the other side thought in the expectations. And I always go back, you know, if you were going to – your wife was expecting a diamond ring on Valentine's Day – and you gave her a gold charm. While the gold charm is great, I can promise you, in her mind, when she looks at that gold charm, the real value of it is not going to be seen because the expectation was a diamond. And so I think at the end of the day, it goes to a scenario that is similar to that.
It was a complex deal.
It is a complex deal.
But it sounds like again, you know, not that the press is going to get it right all the time unless you listen to Bourbon in the Back Room. But it does sound like that the city did not come through on some of their financial obligations. Is that a fair statement?
I wouldn't say that's a fair statement.
Okay.
It is a statement, and I think
thank you.
About that wit earlier.
I think that
I made a statement.
Yeah, so what really happened, Gary?
And that's what I can't really tell you everything that happened. But I will tell you that from the state's perspective, which is what I was involved in, and what happened not only from the legislation that we've already talked about, but what happened with the interchange that comes from that, the Not Panthers interchange now.
is that what it's going to be called,
the Not Panthers interchange? That is an important economic development component for us in York County, whether the Panthers end up on that particular site.
So your hope is the interchange is it completed?
It is being built and is ahead of schedule.
What about the Gary Simrell interchange?
There you go.
Yeah, let's not do that.
And Gary, but your hope is that interchange will be constructively used for economic development.
And it will.
Sure.
And so I always tell folks, you know, if you went to Columbia and you came home and said, look, I got in the budget this year an interchange that you didn't have to pay for locally. It was a gift from 5.2 million South Carolinians,
right?
You know, you would be hailed. This is fantastic because it's connected to this project now. It dims in that light. At the end of the day, with the Carolina Panthers, I hope that there is a way to salvage this relationship.
That's what I was going
to
ask.
Salvage this contract to make it happen for them. If not, South Carolina, as you know, is a great place to do business. York County is a great place to do business. That is 240 acres of prime, beautiful real estate that is connected to an interstate and has its own interchange. It is also connected to Rock Hill.
Oh, it'll be used for something. Yeah.
It will, in 10 years, it's going to be great Panther or Pantherless.
Good. Got Pantherless. Okay. Got two other things I want to talk to you about real quick. The budget, we're starting to see some real major differences between what the Senate is considering and what the House passed. Can you speak to that a little bit? I think one of the big differences is in the size of the tax break. So y'all's budget
and teacher pay,
starting teacher pay, and the bonus for state employees. Right. I understand that y'all had like a bonus for
higher ed dollars.
Huh?
Higher ed dollars.
All right, so talk to us a little bit about
that,
the difference.
We call that tuition control.
Tuition mitigation, which to Mr. Sheen's credit, that was his brainchild.
I mean, we spend so much time with this talking about all the great things.
Come back on the show, Gary.
That Vincent did. Gary, it's amazing that the legislature still functions without him.
That's why Gary.
Well, he reminds us of that.
All right, tell us about the major difference.
So the major difference, I think you hit it, is the size of the tax cut. And I think for the House's perspective, or from our perspective, what we did was took the top rate of 7% and down to 6% over a five-year period with at least a 5% growth mark during those 5 years. So it does have a trigger. But that's not the best part of what the House did. What the House did was took the 6, 5, 4, and 3 rates and collapsed them all into 3%. So if you look at the people of South Carolina who do most of the working and lifting in this state, that's about a 25% reduction in their tax liability. Remember, in South Carolina, the average South Carolinian has about a $2,300 a year, less than $200 a month tax liability for this state. I mean, we're one of the—
For the South Carolina portion of that.
Correct.
Yeah,
we're one of the lowest— right. In the nation, states collecting money, liability on you as a citizen. So this is a help for that. But our plan is sustainable, and it really it passed unanimously. This was my bill. It passed unanimously. We had buy-in from Democrats and Republicans, and I worked from that point to build consensus with my Democrat colleagues because—
You had Democrats vote for this tax cut bill.
It passed unanimously.
Wait a second, Gary. He just said it passed unanimously.
I'm sorry.
So yeah,
that means everybody.
Yeah.
You can put that on there.
but that's an important
just to emphasize that.
That's an important component of how this works. So the Senate goes from 7% to 5.7 in a much quicker period, but they also give a rebate. So
of like what, $100?
I don't know
the result of all that is teachers don't make as much money in the first year under the Senate plan.
And so let's talk about teachers just a moment.
Okay.
So you go back 4 years where we really started having the teacher shortage. This is pre-COVID.
Right.
But we were in the throes of teachers leaving. The attrition rate was high. We realized we've got to pay more. Over from 2018-19 to where we are today in the House's budget, and these others obviously became law through the budget, but we've had about a 30% increase in teacher pay over that period. We wanted to benchmark $40,000 as
sure.
beginning pay, so that unfortunately is not done in the Senate's version. For state employees in South Carolina, a 3% raise, which the Senate has matched at 3%, we added a $1,500 bonus.
For every state employee?
For state employees, 100,000 and below.
Wow.
And so that was important. That's not included in that plan. Tuition mitigation that we talked about a minute ago, it's still there, some of it's lessened. But here's the key on higher ed, and this is why this is important. 2002 is an election year in South Carolina. Governor Hodges is defeated by Governor Sanford. Beginning in 2003, Governor Sanford didn't want to borrow any money. Heretofore, whether it was Governor Campbell or Governor Beasley or Governor Hodges, we would have an abbreviated bond bill that took care of
capital improvements.
Right.
Like a mortgage on your home.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, somebody says, run government like a business.
Right.
Well, I can tell you, I run a business, and I have to borrow money to run my business.
Because it makes sense to borrow money at low rates.
You're using the economies of scale that you're given to make things happen quicker. So government can utilize the same functions. By the way, as an aside, South Carolina can have a 5% debt compared to our revenues. Do you know what our debt is today? Less than 0.25%.
Yeah. Wow.
Correct. So we don't borrow on
last time we had a big bill was the bond bill of 99, the $1 billion bond
correct.
Bill.
So we did not borrow from 2003 to 2010. Governor Sanford, when he leaves office, Governor Haley, if you'll remember this, Vincent, is elected, and she is of the same.
He kind of remembers.
She is of the same mindset, and so
sneaky.
You take 2008, 2009. for higher ed. Remembering technology at this point is expanding rapidly. Colleges are not able to keep up. They have to borrow their own money. And so
they finance? They're borrowing tuition increases.
Tuition increases. So it came to light that about 20% on average of your tuition bill paid at universities is debt. And that was the state's fault. We should have been, if it's a state-supported institution, we should be supporting the institution as a state. Okay, pretty simple, but it was not happening. What I set out to do when I became higher ed chair in the House is I took Mr. Shaheen's format of tuition mitigation. We worked with Governor McMaster. We funded it. We front-loaded it. But we also took the Capital Reserve Fund, and we started working through the backlog of maintenance, of capital projects, of technology needs on our college campuses. Unfortunately, in this budget thus far in the Senate, most of those dollars have been wiped away.
Okay, so Gary, the budget, just tell our listeners how ultimately this ends. What is the process for where the differences in each chamber come together?
So the House passes the budget. The Senate gets it, goes through the entire process, sends it back to the House. The House does what's called H2, House 2. So we amend back to our original budget with maybe some changes, but for the most part, it is that in a nutshell. Send it back to the Senate. This sets us up for conference. Conference meaning three members of the Senate, three members of the House. We get together as six individuals and work toward adopting Senate language, House language, working through this process. We always gear our budget to set it up for conference. Currently, the Senate budget, I don't know that it's set up for conference, is set up more for a standoff.
I was just sitting here thinking, in all my years, there's some pretty large differences of opinion with regard to tax cuts and education funding.
Well, and even beyond, there are. And beyond that, the two bodies generally leave room to negotiate things. So let's say the House puts $10 million on a particular line to fund, college improvements. Generally, the Senate would, even if they didn't agree, they'd put a dollar on the line so that the two bodies could negotiate back and forth. But if the Senate puts zero on the line, then it's an all or nothing thing.
See, that theirs means, ours. Yeah.
Which means it is very difficult to negotiate. And Gary, I understand that's the type of thing that you're seeing.
That is correct.
Why Jay Lucas said he wouldn't. All right, Gary, last question. Real quick, we've talked a lot on our podcast about the USC board. Yep. Where does this whole mess end up?
So we passed a bill dealing with USC board. We were at 13 members, and it's divided up well within South Carolina.
Sure, we've talked about that. The Senate's going to 15.
15 members, but I think they were looking, the last I saw, at large on these members. We want to be able to protect more rural areas of representation.
Thank you, sir.
The fabric of South Carolina dictates that you have broad representation. I think that's extremely important. The good news is that both the House and the Senate recognize the importance of restructuring the board.
Does this end up, though, because, we played a clip earlier where Senator Harpootlian, he doesn't want these five board members that did not get reported out by the screening committee, he wants them gone immediately. We kind of suspect that that's not going to happen, that ultimately the end result is a reconstituted board. Anybody who wants to file can file. They have a new set of elections next spring, and they all take place July 1st or something like that.
So you will have an election May 4th. Several of those members will not be on the ballot. They will be carryover members. Again, November elections next year is a brand new General Assembly, so no carryover legislation unless something will be worked out ahead of time. They can always pass a piece of legislation, again, setting those dates as how they want to work the screening. I don't think you'll see another screening session this session. You will have the election on May 4th, but you'll have carryover candidates.
But don't you think a bill passes this year? Some version.
There's no reason it shouldn't. So right. My salvo to the Senate is work with us.
Gotcha. All right. Work with us. I like it. That might be a theme for the service of Gary Semerl. Gary, you've been on the show twice as a member of the House of Representatives. We thank you for coming back today, and we want to welcome you back next year when you come tell us what it's like on the outside.
As a retired member of the House of Representatives, thank you, Gary Simrell, for your service and for being a guest on Bourbon in the Back Room. We'll be right back.
Joel, I'm really excited to hear that we have another new sponsor of Bourbon in the Back Room. Tell our audience who it is.
So, Vincent, let me tell you and all of our listeners about South Carolina's only locally based health insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina, one of our sponsors of Bourbon in the Back Room. They've got all your health insurance needs covered through all stages of life. Whether it's individual and family coverage, group coverage, or Medicare, you can count on Blue Cross for quality health insurance close to home. In fact, South Carolinians have counted on Blue Cross, you ready for this, Vincent? For 75 years.
Wow.
So if you need health insurance, let Blue Cross take care of you, your family, or your employees.
Welcome, Blue Cross Blue Shield, to Bourbon in the Back Room.
All right, we'll be right back. This is Shaheen. We are back, and our friend Gary Simrell. What a funny guy, right?
Gary's great. Good
guy. Having some funny laughs.
After we were recording and he was leaving, he kept telling stories.
Oh, man.
It was great. Listeners, it's worth you going and watching some of Gary's speeches from the House floor. He's great. He's fun. We'll miss him in the South Carolina House. Joel, I think the thing I took away from our interview was just a reminder of how this guy who came in truly as a partisan politico became a very substantive deal maker, and that's democracy at its best. It's what we've seen. I also was struck by your discussion with him about the dueling versions of income tax cuts, and that reminded me of how dysfunctional it is to have a one-party state, where really you have a conversation that leaves out the whole other side of it, which is what should we be doing to fund state government? What should we be doing to make it run better and more efficiently? Instead, it's just a contest, kind of a race to the bottom of how many taxes that we can cut and how much we can cut them. I don't know if you caught it, but he actually subtly said, you know, the average tax bill in South Carolina, I think he said, was like $200 a month, and lots and lots of South Carolinians pay zero in
right.
state
and
income tax.
You've talked about that on
yeah.
the show,
so, too. You know, he knows the deal, and I think what you see coming out of the House is an attempt to have some tax reform that's modest but still allows you to run your government. But now they're in this fight with the Senate on who can go to the farthest right. That's not healthy. We'll miss Gary in the South Carolina House. Your thoughts?
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm just sitting here thinking about people like Gary Simrell that could reach across the aisle that will no longer be serving. I think about our previous guest a few weeks ago, Greg Gregory.
Yeah.
I think about you. I think about Gary. I think about Jay Lucas. And, you know, and I think about some of the people that are still serving, the Brad Huttos, the Nikki Setzlers, the Sean Bennetts in the right. Senate. And what worries me of what comes after
yeah, them. Like I don't see the new replacements of those people, and maybe they'll grow into it, but right now we're letting different types of people.
Yeah, people now are running much harder to the right or the left on ideologically extreme-type agendas, and I think that does not bode well for the process. I hope I'm wrong, and hopefully as they come in, they will mature like a Gary Simrell, who came in very much like
right.
a political hack.
Right, and that's a powerful story to hear that, because it also gives you hope for change and for improvement, because the system, if you allow it to work, it can work.
And that's a story you will only hear where, Vincent?
Bourbon in the Back Room. We enjoyed it, and we'll see you back next week.
Bourbon in the Back Room is produced by Austin Shaheen and Campbell Douglas, marketing and research by Holly Van Horn.